trouble with the Lilith? You tired of having your home space violated? You want to get rid of them pesky living critters once and for all? Well, come on down and see me, folks, because I'm the afterlife's leading bioelectricist.
Greetings, travelers. You have discovered Dragon Reel, a magical journey into the realm of fantasy movies. Enter, if you dare.
Welcome back to the Dragon Reel podcast. This is episode 10, Beetlejuice. I am your host, Chris, and I'm feeling a little anxious, if you know what I mean. And in chair number two tonight, she is strange and unusual. It's Sharon.
I'm very strange and very unusual. I will be very serious tonight and not make any jokes whatsoever.
No, I'm sorry you're not emo enough for this broadcast. Next!
You must be this emo to ride this show.
It's really hard for me to be emo because I'm a very happy person. So that right. Just took all my energy.
Well, you can take some lessons from our next host in chair number three, just back from his plummet off the Winter River Bridge. It's Pete.
And I am utterly alone.
See? There you go. You could pick up a tip or two. In chair number four, joining us for the first time ever, Calvin!
It's showtime!
Welcome to the show, Calvin. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here. Oh, man. Good to be in touch with y'all.
Whenever I think of Beetlejuice, I think of Calvin.
Oh, my.
Wow.
He looks nothing like Michael Keaton.
That's complimentary.
Ooh.
in a strange way.
Because there are a few people that I know to be more of a scholar of Beetlejuice than Calvin himself.
It's my favorite film. You're one of my favorite films.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, Calvin, to let the listeners get to know you a little bit.
Okay, I'm in my late 50s. I retired recently from federal service. I do.
Well done, sir.
Do amateur and professional theater for amateur and professional reasons. But anyway, it's very fun. And
he's quite good. I've seen him perform.
We live in
phrasing.
I meant perform as a lesbian.
Phrasing.
What?
Phrasing.
My wife and I perform in Northwest Georgia.
Phrasing.
Yeah, phrasing. I'm phrasing the heck out of this. But anyway, I spent a good long time in the Maryland area and got to know Chris and Sharon and Pete and everybody, and yeah.
So we're going to talk about Beetlejuice, which is one of the first movies that I saw, one of the first Tim Burton movies that I saw. How does it fall in the Tim Burton canon?
Let me see. I think it's his second.
Second, okay.
After
Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Right?
Pee-wee's Big Adventure, yeah.
We won't count that one.
I think, and it was right before Batman.
Mm-hmm. Where does Edward Scissorhands fall in this?
That's in the early 90s. I think that was 91.
I think it was after.
That was before Ed Wood, but it was after Batman.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And would you categorize this as comedy horror, or what genre? Comedy horror.
Comedy horror, but then I want to throw in what the Rolling Stone, either Rolling Stone or Premiere magazine, I think it might have been the Rolling Stone now that I think of it, said about it. They had this article that just went on and on about the film even before I saw it, and they talked about its alternate reality, and that's really what it is. It's an alternate reality film.
It's an alternate reality constructed by German expressionists.
I guess.
there's some hardcore Germanist, impressionist.
And a lot of Wizard of Oz.
Stuff going on.
Yes,
there, yeah.
I agree with that. I'm glad that Calvin said that because it's on our show. It's on Dragon Reel, so it's fantasy too.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
It is decidedly fantastical. Mm-hmm.
So I saw this movie a long time ago, like probably everybody else here.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw the cabinet of Dr. Caligari, a 1920s silent film, everything about Tim Burton suddenly became clear.
Was Caligari an old Hitchcock film? No, it wasn't. No, but he was inspired by it anyway.
Very probably.
Yeah, very much so, especially in things like Vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of the aesthetic of this movie and other. And I remember watching a animated short by Tim Burton about a boy named Vincent.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed very German expressionist. After I'd seen Caligari, I saw that shed a whole new light on that movie as well.
Hear, hear.
Yeah, that's right. I saw a little bit of Vincent, and I haven't seen Frankenweenie yet.
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah.
So should we have Calvin summarize this movie and his...
Calvin, why don't you tell us what Beetlejuice is about?
What Beetlejuice is about? Beetlejuice is about There's No Place Like Home. But anyway, that line actually appears in the film, and I was just freaked out by it. But anyway, Adam and Barbara Maitland live up in Winter River, Connecticut, and they have a house. And they take very good care of this old house, they're always doing work on it. And they're fascinated by the small little town of Winter River. Adam has even made a model of the entire town, which he keeps up in the attic.
Nice fucking model!
Yep. Sorry, I had to share that.
Anyway, they die. They have a tragic accident that happened on the Winter River Bridge, and hopefully it got repaired before... Winona Ryder wanted to commit suicide off of it. Anyway.
And usually that's where a film ends, but where this one starts.
But in fact, their death is triggered by Barbara saying the words, there's no place like home. And they happen to be in the car at the time and happen to be swerving to avoid a dog.
A little dog.
Oh my gosh, I never thought of that.
Right? That's why I brought him in.
They return to the house, and then they find out they cannot escape the house, and then they figure out they're dead, and there's a book in the house, the handbook for the recently deceased. They can't escape, and now people are moving into their house, which is clearly marked for sale. No one can see them, and they have to figure out how to get these awful people, and they really truly are awful people. But the rest of the movie takes place with them finding more and more about the world that they're in. It's the afterlife, basically.
Yes.
This disreputable character has been setting up residence in Adam's model.
Would this be Betelgeuse?
That would be Betelgeuse, who is sometimes pronounced Betelgeuse, sometimes pronounced Beetlemeyer, sometimes.
Right, forgot about Beetlemeyer.
Breakfast.
Get all that Beetlemeyer fellow.
Alec Baldwin, at one point, his character, Adam Maitland, calls him Beetlemeyer. Let's call this Beetlemeyer guy. And so they eventually figure out how to call Beetlejuice, and call him they do, and wreak havoc he does. But the people living in the house think it's great. The house is haunted. They can sell tickets to this darn thing, and so everyone's all kind of happy, except for Winona Ryder, who hates her parents, her father and her stepmother, and it ends up in near cataclysm. But after a while, everything's okay, and the family decides that the ghost family, they can live together, and they end up with a new book, The Living and the Dead, Peaceful Coexistence, or something like that.
Yeah, I didn't actually catch the subtitle of that. I suppose, in this day and age, I should have just stopped the DVD to look at it. But
yeah, I forget. It's The Living and the Dead. It doesn't say Peaceful Coexistence, but it says something along, something... Mm-hmm. About
something
harmonious.
Like that, and for dummies or something,
Harmonious.
Book one.
Hilarity
and,
results.
And Lydia passes the math test.
Right.
Right, and so the end, we're done.
I was worried about that math test.
Well, she did get a C on the science test, so there was some doubt.
You never passed a test in science.
I love the music in this movie.
Oh, Danny,
Danny Elfman.
Yeah,
I think this may have been his second or third score.
It was right before he did Batman, mm-hmm. and Tim Burton did Batman, and so they were just They were just getting warmed up, fellas.
Yeah. Whoa. When they find the book for the first time, the musical cues, I think, are outright hilarious. I got to play them for you.
Okay.
And there's that.
I love the shit.
Handbook for the recently diseased.
Deceased.
Deceased.
My favorite part about that is the look on Alec Baldwin's face, which is like, oh, that's bad too.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Gina Davis has made a career of playing strong women and advocating for strong women in Hollywood. And she's done a marvelous job making Barbara Maitland just this strong woman to...
Very strong woman.
To dopey Adam Maitland. You almost want to go Rocky Horror on his butt.
she's fantastic, and she really cares about Lydia.
Yes,
I like it when she's sort of asking him, "Can you tell me about the manual?
Why did you disappear when you stepped off the porch? Are we halfway to heaven? Are we halfway to hell? And how long is this going to last?"
I don't see anything about heaven or hell. This book reads like stereo instructions.
Yep.
Yes.
Stereo instructions.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you said earlier, during your summary.
Comparing everything after this movie, everybody was saying that anything reasonably complicated was read like stereo instructions.
Yes.
I've heard that expression so many times since this movie.
Well, so are you saying that life imitates movies, or movies imitates real life?
Well, the thing is, people would say that about stereo instructions, that they were unreadable and usually written by people who did not have a mastery of the language they were writing in. But,
well, and they were oftentimes unnecessarily complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. Individual and temporal parameters. Functional parameters may vary from manifestation to manifestation.
Exactly. Which makes perfect sense to me, personally, but then again, I've written many books for the recent season.
The Maitlands were absolutely the least metaphysical people you ever wanted to meet.
Ain't that the truth? They were so salt of the earth, they couldn't escape it.
Absolutely, and Juno had to come in, which I love Sylvia Sidney. Oh, she had to come in and basically teach them how to haunt.
Speaking of Sylvia Sidney. Me too. I agree with you. I love her scratchy voice.
Yeah. I recommend you go to her IMDb page.
Spectacular.
Wow.
She was a fox, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
What a fox.
And it looks like she worked pretty consistently from like 1929 to 1999 when she died.
Wow.
Very nice.
Seven decades. Good for her.
Yeah, she kept working for Tim Burton.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, she was in Mars Attacks.
That she really got to work a lot. And I liked her voice. She had that sort of scratchy.
That whiskey and cigarettes.
Stevie Nicks type of.
Yes. I felt kind of sad when she was in Mars Attacks because I felt like, some of the senility was probably really there,
Yeah, no, true. But.
And every supporting actor or actress in this was very strong.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of one person that I didn't believe that they were that person.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have a clip from her, Chris?
Mm-hmm.
The intermediate interface chapter on haunting says it all. Get them out yourselves. It's your house.
It's your house.
It's your house.
Yep.
Get them out yourselves. It's your house.
You don't want his help. He does not play well.
Coach, I don't think we survived that crash. What was your first guess?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not your coach.
Men's room.
He survived.
So, in the same scene, she tells us exactly who Beetlejuice is. I mean, assuming what she's saying is true, and we don't have any reason to doubt her at any point.
Right.
And that's this.
He was my assistant. But he was a troublemaker. He went out on his own as a freelance bioexorcist. Claimed he could get rid of the living. Got into more trouble.
Hearing a little Peter and the Wolf in the background there?
Not only that, but listen to the way that she changes her cadence.
Yeah.
And the way that she changes, she rounds out everything and makes it a little quieter, like she's being conspiratorial and she's letting us in on it.
And that's a
secret. Fantastic. I'm going to tell you about it.
Yeah, exactly.
I noticed something else about this alternate reality that they set up with this movie. You don't hear much about good or evil, heaven or hell. When she's describing when she's describing Beetlejuice, he's not evil, he's just a troublemaker.
He's a good point, Calvin. We need an applause track because
yay.
I didn't get that in watching it.
That's what she said.
I only just figured it out.
And now that you say it, it's very true. 100 cookie points for Calvin.
Cookie points. Yay.
You mentioned something earlier, Calvin, and I want to point out, I don't think Lydia hates her dad. I think she really genuinely loves, I'm drawing a blank on his name.
Charles. Let's see. Charles.
I think she genuinely loves Charles. I just don't think, I think he's just such a knucklehead, you know, she just can't seem to get through, and that's a source of frustration. But I don't think she hates her. Now, Delia, on the other hand, I saw this many times in the theater when it first came out with a good friend of mine named Eddie, and one of the things he pointed out was the difference between Delia, the stepmother, and Lydia, is the fact that Delia is essentially Lydia backwards. So that's why they're opposites. That's why, if you also notice that Delia never looks Lydia in the face. She never once makes any kind of any form of eye or face contact until she tells her, when she's banging on the door to the attic, that you can't let people walk over you.
Yep.
So throughout the entire movie, she closes her eyes whenever she faces directly at her.
Yep.
Or she looks down.
Or she looks down and chops vegetables very fast.
Right, exactly. But she never once looks Lydia in the face until that one seminal moment.
Yeah.
So. Wow.
So she is her stepmom. Now, we don't know the whole story.
We know that because when Adam says to Lydia, you know, we were trying to scare your mother, and she says stepmother.
Yeah.
But she doesn't object when Chuck says something.
Don't bait your mother, Pumpkin. As soon as we get settled, we'll build you a dark room in the basement, okay?
My whole life is a dark room. One big,
dark room.
And kudos to Winona Ryder for being one of the early goths.
You know what? She's kind of mid goth era, but she's proto emo, which is really where the money is.
Yeah,
that's true.
Amazing.
Everybody. When I think South Park did their little emo kids, they fashioned them kind of out after.
I love that she's sitting and eating dinner wearing like a
vest.
That's great too. Mm-hmm. So I like the fact that she informs them that she's planning on having a stroke from the amount of MSG in the food.
Yes, very very appropriate.
And the wording on her suicide note is just never satisfactory unless it could be amped up a little bit.
I am alone.
Yes,
I am utterly alone.
Utterly alone.
Yep.
And she erased a couple more, I think, there too.
No, it's having jumped, and then she crosses out and writes having
plummeted
to my death of the Winter River Bridge. Yeah.
The only thing I didn't like about the choice of words. They kept calling her a little girl, and I'm like, okay, she's not a little girl. A little girl is like 7.
I think maybe 16. The Dietzes were just so protective of their stepdaughter, you know, of their little girl.
Yeah, but I think it's even the ghost that says, "I like that little girl."
Yeah,
it is. It's Barbara. Yeah. Barbara says that an awful lot.
She says that little girl saw us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but she's 16.
Mm-hmm. But I think that's to show exactly how clueless Adam and Barbara are. They don't get it. They don't understand that she's probably small for her age and that she's totally emo.
Or do you think they wanted a different actress for that part?
I don't think they wanted a different actress, but I think the character is supposed to be younger. I think the character maybe is supposed to be 12 or
13. In the original script, there was supposed to be a second daughter who is 6 or 7.
She says, "I'm a child, for God's sake," when she's beating on the wall.
That's the only thing that I don't like is because most 16-year-olds, I mean, especially when our daughter was 16, she would have not called herself a child. No way, no how. She would have been a child. And Calvin, you know, you had a 16-year-old once.
Yeah, absolutely. And the funny thing is there was a line in Beetlejuice that I did not understand at all for many, many years.
Which was?
When he says Edgar Allan Poe's daughter.
Yeah, the only one I think gets me is Edgar Allan Poe's daughter. I think she understands me.
Kind of mumbles that, and I have absolutely did not understand that.
I assumed he meant Lydia.
Yeah,
exactly.
Because she's, you know, the emo goth.
Right. But that's exactly what he means.
I don't know if I ever heard the line before today.
Oh, yeah.
because when we were listening to it today, it made perfect sense. Yeah. But I didn't remember it as being a line from this movie previously.
Now, the interesting thing, because I'd seen it so many times with my friend Eddie, he knew that line. So I asked him when I first heard it in a viewing with him, I said, what does he say there? And he told me, and I went, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Oh, yes, it made sense. But I thought he said that ground pole's daughter, which I thought. Which I thought was referring to the real estate guy, which so I figured it out, you know, what he meant. He meant with so.
Well, there's a point in time when he's trying to step on Adam's teeth when they're doing the novelty teeth thing.
Yes.
And he goes scram, and I never caught what he was saying until probably the second to last viewing.
Oh my goodness! And that was another case of the wonderful music. When he does that, and then he shouts, come on! And the music just comes up right under him, which is just so great.
Yeah, there's a lot of little, not really just Easter eggs, things. Because that's kind of like a reference to something else, right, but just little nuggets of gold to be found in this.
Phrasing! But I think a lot of it is, I think it's very interesting that you've got what Calvin was talking about, especially with like alternate realities, where you've got what is happening to the Maitlands being trapped within the dimensions of their house.
Right.
And then within their house is the town. And within the town is Beetlejuice.
Right.
You know, and things like that. So it's...
the Stagnant Bar.
You know.
Oh, wasn't there a strip club in there? And
yep.
And the wife said, why did you put that in the town? He goes, I didn't.
Inferno Room. Dante's Inferno Room.
Right. Live nude girls. Yep.
Yeah, Juno put it in, right, Calvin?
Yeah, her house was mine.
She even says,
I want Beetlejuice out of the picture.
And I like how all the women are devils. I always thought that was a nice touch. Oh, they're beckoning to him, and they're devils.
Oh, yeah, they're devils, yes.
So, here I come, baby.
Feeling a little bit anxious. You know,
I wonder where an everyday Joe such as myself could find a little action.
Action.
Woohoo!
So, did this movie make Michael Keaton?
Oh, I don't know. The thing is, I went to see it because I saw Michael Keaton was in it, and I had loved his work in Night Shift.
Night Shift was what I knew him from already.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was calling him Mr. Mom.
I remember him from Mr. Mom, too.
Yeah, I think Johnny Dangerously.
Oh, I think Johnny Dangerously is what made Michael Keaton.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I remember Gung Ho feeling like one of those formulaic movies, and I remember thinking, oh, this actor has arrived, and now he's going to hover in these mediocre movies.
No, well, I think he did something like Gung Ho to pay for something like Clean and Sober.
I would like to answer your question. I don't know if anybody really answered it. You said, did this make him? I would say yes. I can vaguely remember 88. His famous line, and I think everybody knows what his famous little monologue in this is.
Mm-hmm. It's probably the most quoted line on this podcast.
Yeah, probably.
So I think we have to hear it, and then...
I blame Chris for that, by the way.
What are your qualifications?
Ah, well, I attended Juilliard. I'm a graduate of the Harvard Business School. I travel quite extensively. I lived through the Black Plague, and I had a pretty good time during that. I've seen The Exorcist about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every single time I see it! Not to mention the fact that you're talking to a dead guy! Now, what do you think? You think I'm qualified?
Qualified. Yep.
167, an important number to remember.
Exactly.
And we say it we say the right number every time.
Oh, that's right. That is so great. A bunch of years ago, back in high school, way before Beetlejuice or anything like that, I wrote this little satirical book, and I wrote about a friend of mine who was just the sort of person that he would sit through The Exorcist and fall on the floor laughing.
And he'd have a pretty good time doing it.
Yes, he would.
So. I didn't notice some of the crude stuff, believe it or not. And I was cited back in 88. And
crude stuff is a little languagey, though.
It didn't strike me. Like, he's kind of really despicable. Like,
what rating did this movie
PG.
Have? Okay, so there was one F-bomb in the whole
movie. No, there were two F-bombs.
Two F-bombs, really?
Yes. There's one during the marriage scene also.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah.
And he says it really, he says it in a real hiss, so it's hard to catch. He goes, fuck off.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, but it's really, it goes by so quickly, you blink and you'll miss it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are two, but that's it. I mean, there's no nudity.
That one was more on the edge in terms of the standards, because if you use it as a verb, that's the worst way you can use it.
Yeah. Well, he kind of grabs Barbara in the scene where they're in
Barbara,
the...
He grabs himself.
He is sort of molesting the woman in the waiting room. The way Chris described it was she was split in half.
Yeah.
She was a magician's assistant who had been cut in half.
He pantomimes going blind.
Right. Yeah, he does that little jerk off motion.
Okay.
So speaking of the people in the afterlife, why is the girl with the slit wrists, why is she like that color?
She's exsanguinated.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess she's exsanguinated, but I don't know why they did that. They made her nice and blue to contrast with her bright orange hair.
Right.
But at the same time, she's Miss Venezuela.
Right.
So. Apparently, now I'm not sure if this is true, but apparently one of the reasons why they made her that color was because that was the color of paint that her skin could tolerate.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
But the basis of it was, according to my buddy Eddie at least, was that the reason why she was so blue was because she managed to do such a good job of slitting her wrists, she was completely exsanguinated.
Completely exsanguinated. Okay.
Fascinating.
Okay, whereas the woman cut in half only turned kind of white.
Yeah, it was kind of a bluish white.
Bluish white with a red, really red dress.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm not sure if I'm buying the exsanguinated answer, but okay.
No, but really, I think what it comes down to is that's the color of paint that her skin would tolerate.
Okay.
And we all know why she was there, as Otho says.
Absolutely.
You know what they say about people who commit suicide? In the afterlife, they become civil servants.
And he was right.
And it turns out,
He was right about, most of the kooky things that he believed, and he got hold of the handbook and was able to perform the ceremony to an extent of success that shocked even him. He was scared.
He was also right about the Viridian. I mean, it really worked on that wall.
Come on!
And the best part was that I read his mind, and so few people are open to that experience.
But I didn't understand the role of the person that was sitting next to him at the table for the Calypso number.
Mm. She is the writer for Art in America.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, okay. Because this was, it seemed like his date, but then he had this attitude toward her, to each other.
Is that what they're calling your kind these days?
Don't mind her. She's still upset because somebody dropped a house on her sister.
Well, first off, you're never sure about Otho's sexuality.
Right.
He's purposely androgynous.
I don't know if you're not sure, because it seemed pretty... pretty obvious to me.
No, but I think that's part of what Otho is. It makes him so able to work with the supernatural parts.
It's the fact that
he's puckish. He's got a Peter Panish quality to him.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't stay in one job long. He, you know, everybody, Possibly. The world revolves around him. You know, that kind of thing. So
I kind of sometimes got the impression that he. And Delia might have trysted. I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There might have been a little something there. So
he was very familiar with Delia. I was sort of surprised because I think that's a good point, Calvin. I know I'm probably reading way too much into this, but he says, oh, stop it, Delia, at one point.
Yes.
And that's not her husband. That is her interior decorator. Mm-hmm. So.
Right. Also, a caricature you're not going to see much of these days. You know, right. the very queenly interior decorator.
Yes.
Well,
he's not that queenie. Mm. He's more puckish than queenie.
The one throwaway joke, which I don't know, just the way they set it up, it to me didn't work, or I don't know about joke, but it was a line that was kind of supposed to be significant. You're supposed to know why Otho is coming in through the window and wearing red shoes to avoid bad luck.
Mm.
He says bad luck, but it's while he's crashing through the blinds.
Right. Okay. So he goes, why can't you just come in through the door? And he said, because it's bad luck.
Bad luck.
What was the name of his date?
That I don't know.
That I'm trying to think because Jeffrey Jones does address her at one point.
Yeah.
And she answers by saying that the National Enquirer will pay money for proof of the afterlife.
Mm-hmm. Let me see. Full cast and crew. I'm.
Was it Beryl?
Yes, it was Beryl.
Yes.
Was it?
Yes. It was okay. Beryl.
So I don't recognize. I didn't recognize her from anything else.
Yeah, Adele Lutz. Yeah, Beryl.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Apparently, she was in The Silence of the Lambs, which would be the only thing on here I've seen.
As what?
Yeah,
a TV anchor woman, throwaway.
Oh,
part.
Gotcha. Okay, gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. She was in Wall Street.
I loved her. She was great in that little bit that she added to the film, and being kind of the counterweight to Otho. Yeah.
What an uncomfortable dinner scene. I mean, until they start playing the calypso music.
Yeah.
You know, I would feel totally embarrassed being at that dinner table with everybody.
And I just yeah, and I love the way that Catherine O'Hara as Delia would do the laugh, you know, the uncomfortable laughter, and between her and Jeffrey Jones.
Yes.
Very well done. The uncomfortable emotions of that, and you know, Tim Burton directing it. That was marvelous.
But not only that, but the way that she's kind of calling the shots in the family, you know, and that the fact that there's the moment when she goes, "In designer sheets, no less." And she gives Charles that glare, and he goes, "I'd like to propose a toast to all of our friends."
So what I wasn't sure. In that exact line, I wasn't sure. Is that the moment when she realized that it was her $300 sheets?
Yes.
Okay.
No. She recognizes it. She recognizes that they're her $300 sheets when Dealey's showing her the 8x10s.
Then what was that look?
The look is saying, "Get us out of this conversation." She glares at Charles to say, change the subject. Yeah, change the subject. She glares at him and goes, "Change the subject." And he does. And there are times when she gives him these looks, these winks, these other cues, and he responds accordingly. My favorite part about him, though, is that he is the most gracious host in the world, because even when Dick Cavett says, "Delia, you are a flake. You have always been a flake.
Yes.
And if you're going to scare somebody, do it with your sculptures." And they close the door, and Charles Dietz goes, "Drive safe."
But I think maybe what made her eyes go wide in my mind is that she realized those sheets are ruined.
No, that's what I thought too. She's cueing to Charles. She's saying, "Change the subject. Get us off this topic."
Well, we'll see. Mm-hmm. Everybody, you know, has different opinions, and I don't really care about the sheets because I couldn't see that look. Yeah. And
there you go.
You know, so but it does give us insight into. At least the daughter thinks, "Wow, mom's really going to care." Or dad, somebody thinks that she's going to care about
the sheets. Yeah, your mother's going to throw a fit when she sees what you've done to her $300 sheets.
Exactly. So that tells us that she's a materialistic person. And a lot of people in this, if you think about it, are sort of really, what's the correct word, reprehensible characters?
Yes.
They're all pretty disgusting people.
Disgusting people. The ghosts are the nicest people in the whole movie, really. Mm-hmm.
Yes, somehow, Tim Burton creates a sympathetic moment for just about everybody in there.
Yes.
There's the outdoor scene where, you know, why are there only three sculptures, blah, 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 and she tells the guy, "Do you think I want to die like this?"
Yeah, this is my art and it's very dangerous. Do you think I want to die like this?
Right. Yes. Yep, she realizes her art is ugly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's sad.
She likes it.
It's very Tim Burton-esque.
Yes. As is her art.
Yes, it is. So, and her interior decorator.
So the effects in this movie were all stop motion. I mean, any of the...
Stop motion puppets.
There was no CG. It wasn't a thing yet.
Nope.
So yeah, everything
that was
is
the
stop
thing
motion.
That amazed me was seeing how short the list was for special effects.
Yeah. So the artwork that animated, that was stop motion. Beetlejuice as the snake banister railing.
Puppet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There was some stop motion in there as well.
Right, but it's primarily puppet.
Okay.
It's like someone took David Lynch's early stuff and married it with Walt Disney or somehow. Mm. I don't
know. Yeah.
It's kind of weird that, like, what is it, 2 years later, Jurassic Park made CG? Like, no. Everything would have been done CG if this movie
closer,
was 2 years
closer
later.
Closer to four.
Yes, it was just, that was marvelous.
Yeah, you're right, 93, stuff. Actually.
Thank you.
Face.
Yep.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
Who's the man here?
That would still be me.
Oh, no, not this again.
Actually, Chris, you're the man, and that's the problem.
Yes.
Oh. All right,
so,
back.
I just wanted to say, I mean, it's a highly quotable movie.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The one thing that completely and utterly sold me on this movie was the fact that I have been such a cinemaphile and have been since I was around 11 or 12 that I would go out and see a movie at least 4 to 5 times a month.
Oh.
And I had seen so many movies up until the point that I'd seen Beetlejuice for the first time, and I was so pleased by so many things that surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
The just simple things like the sculpture coming through the window as Charles Dietz is making tea.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
or the draw a door.
Yeah.
And then he draws a knob and tries to turn it. And the fact is that the antagonist shows up in a model.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's effectively trapped on the other side, you know? He has to be summoned over.
Yep.
And I just think there's just so many little things. Even the opening credits where you see Winter River and it's tracking up, and as it tracks, there's that subtle transition to the model. Well,
yes.
Until you see the Maitland's house, and suddenly this monster spider crawls over the roof.
Yeah. Did that become the model?
I knew I wanted to go back and see the movie so I could catch when that transition happened.
When was it? I didn't catch it.
Just after the bridge.
Coming up the street with the camera, and then I knew from the focus that I was looking at something that was the wrong size, and something weird was going to happen.
Uh-huh.
Right.
I also want to point out that he used the same opening tracking model thing on Edward Scissorhands.
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm.
To open that movie.
Which is also a very fairy tale-ish fantasy
movie,
you know.
But I kind of feel that opening crawl was kind of recycled for Edward Scissorhands.
Well, it's kind of funny. When Barry Sonnenfeld did Men in Black, the original one, I was watching the opening of that with David,
the Dragonfly.
Danny Elfman's music and the Dragonfly, and I was going, oh no, not again.
Well, when I saw Men in Black in the theaters, I, for a long time, I was convinced it was a Tim Burton movie.
Yes.
Yes. And might I say, excellent Hitchhiker's Guide reference there, Calvin.
Thank you.
You're welcome. But that's one of the reasons why I kept coming back to it, was the fact that there was something that I got out of it every single time that I watched it that I was willing to, you know, to fork out $5 to $6 a show, you know?
So I've probably only seen this movie maybe 5 or 6 times all the way through.
Wow.
And it does keep getting funnier every single time I see it, because there were things that I have missed in every single viewing. Like
my
today...
point exactly.
For the first time, I caught some of those musical cues that I didn't get before.
Mm-hmm.
Because up until, like, a couple years ago, I really took the music in film for granted.
Did you notice that the role of the background that the house plays as a character in this film?
Oh.
In parts, but tell me what you mean.
Okay, so, for example, the granite paint job on the main foyer and upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you look at the floor when people are walking across it, it looks just like a tile floor. But when the snake dangles Charles over it, it looks like it goes on forever. It has an optical illusion that makes it look like it's infinitely deep.
Oh.
And then the snake's about to drop Charles into a pit.
Okay, yeah.
I did not notice that.
No, I didn't notice that.
The transition they did to the fireplace from the green tile to the marble.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they have a Zen garden in the back to display Delia's sculptures.
Oh.
In the back of the dining room.
Yes, in the back of the dining room. Yes.
Yeah. So and the fact that the dining room, Lydia's room, and one other room are purple. And I can't remember. And then Charles and Delia's rooms are a different color. And then of course there's the room that no one may touch. And when you go into the into the other world, into the afterlife,
there's a
preponderance of purple.
Mm.
I didn't notice the coloring, but I did notice like the oddity of shape. There's no there's no
right angle. There's no perfect right angle.
Right, exactly, and there's no symmetry.
Right, exactly, right. And that's to visually put you off your game.
Right.
Yeah, that's like you said, the German expressionist influence. Mm-hmm.
And when he knocks on the door and that he draws, and it starts to open, the first thing you see is green lights.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you see a preponderance of green in different areas too.
Yeah, in different areas, and then when it cuts back to them, they're coming down through all this mist and smoke and a ceiling fan going around and around, and the green gives way then to the blue and purple. And
right, exactly.
Hmm. Oh, very, very.
Okay, so now here's my question.
Serene, I would say.
If Juno is a civil servant in the afterlife and a very high level civil servant.
Hmm.
Did she slit her own throat?
Yeah, that was the impression I got. I mean, that's what's implied.
She's very flexible. If she did, that cut is pretty good for a person who slit their own throat.
Yeah, and the flat man must have like jumped in front of a truck,
right, or a bus. This is what I was thinking. Right,
right. I mean,
you know, the guy delivering papers desk to desk was, you know, he was in a noose going along. Yeah,
he's still hanging.
The ceiling.
Yeah,
they were pretty consistent with that.
I wonder if you could have gotten someone to help you with your suicide. You know, but.
There would have been so many samurai there, it wouldn't have been funny.
Yeah. So Robert Goulet is in this movie for no good reason.
Yeah. Yes,
like
is.
His character. I mean, he's sort of like Charles's boss, but the movie could have done without him.
Yeah.
And
it's
they
true,
like rush him off the stage as soon as they're done with him.
I think part of it though is the fact that he's got such a great voice.
Mm.
And I think that he is he's supposed to be Charles's foil the way that Delia is Lydia's foil.
Hmm. No one could say putts the way he
Charles, listen, when you worked for me, you were a demon. You know, he's just, God, he's got such a velvet voice.
Yeah, he does have a voice, I'll give him that. But that whole thing could have been done on the phone, you know?
I'm sure.
He didn't have to show up. I don't think that really added anything, other than giving them a reason to have, you know, another dinner.
You know,
I think...
Yeah, launching Robert Goulet through the ceiling was pretty good, yeah.
But I think one of the reasons they did it was so that we showed that Charles can't relax.
Mm.
That he's got to have something. He's got to have a gimmick. He never leaves the city behind.
In the tension of them being there, Chris, I think they did need to be there. If they were just doing it on the phone, it wouldn't have been as anxiety filled.
Well, they could have had Dick Cavett back.
Dick Cavett could. Yeah, I was thinking of Dick Cavett.
Dick Cavett's a little too taciturn.
Mm.
You need somebody who's got the big bushy mustache and the ability to smile around it and have the sparkling eyes and everything like that. So,
Well, here's why Charles was no longer in this city. I've got this clip right here.
Charles, you're lucky the yuppies are buying condos so you can afford what I'm going to have to do to this place.
Also, I'm here to relax and clip coupons.
I like the fact that she licks his nose at that point. I like the little things that Delia does to Charles.
Does she lick his nose?
Yeah.
She licks his nose at that point, yeah.
Whoa. Okay. And
she
also
get any ideas, lady.
She
boops his belly button. She does a lot of different things to him. It's very
and
good.
He gives her a look like eat poop.
Oh.
Yes.
And Calvin, there's maybe another bit of ammunition for your idea that maybe those two were having a little thing.
Hmm.
You know, because she's like, you go off and do your thing, and we're going to do our thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Bow chicka wow wow.
Yeah.
There's some possibility of brown chicken brown cow there.
Yeah.
Just say.
I wouldn't have thought so, but yeah.
I wouldn't have thought so until Calvin said it, and now
like I said, I think Calvin's right. I think there's something to be said for them having some kind of dalliance.
That's why we need to bring the experts on the show.
Well, I mean, and in deference to Chris's opinion on it, I'm thinking Delia might be the only woman who would do it in that way for Otho.
Hey, phrasing!
You're completely correct.
So do you guys have a little favorite scene, or have we already...
Oh, my goodness. Let's see. Well, as I kind of mentioned very briefly before, I just love the Zagnut bit and the fluff.
That is hilarious.
Mm.
What about you, Sharon?
I like the ending. but it's because I'm all soft and mushy, and I like when she comes home from school and they're playing the, you know, and she's asking for something and you don't know what she's asking for. And they say, well, you know, what did you get on your tests? And she did well, and then she gets to do that calypso music and float up.
She gets a haunting.
Okay. So I like that. But I like when she talks to them and they're covered in sheets. And it's like she's just so brave and a very strong character. And she's...
Oh, yeah, this part right here, she's like so nonplussed by the idea that there are ghosts in front of her.
Are you gross under there?
Sheets. Are you gross under there?
Underwear.
Are you Night of the Living Dead under there?
You said
like
underwear.
Like all bloody veins and pus?
Night of the what?
And she's just like, are you gross? Are you disfigured? You know, like...
Because that would be
like,
really cool.
Yeah, you know she's thinking, that would be so awesome.
And I love the... I love the corniness a few seconds earlier. We're ghosts!
Already dead!
Exactly.
So I liked a lot of parts with Lydia. And I actually... I realize now, seeing it a long time after when I saw it before, that
You're not fooling anyone.
I couldn't relate to Lydia at all. Shut up. When I was 18, you know, a certain age. And now, I think Lydia is so darn cute. I just want to give her an ice cream cone. And
she's
just like,
gothically adorable.
Yeah. So as a mom who is almost becoming a grandmom, you know, I just think she's adorable. And I would just want to go, I want to buy you a pink dress with some black on it and buy you an ice cream cone.
Let's go to Hot Topic. You're mine now.
Yeah. And so I think that when you see a movie and then you see it 30 years later, wait, not quite, but when you see
almost,
it decades later, it truly makes a different impression on you. Mm-hmm. And so my favorite character when it came out in 88 is totally different from my favorite character now.
Who was your favorite character in 88?
It was not her.
Probably the Barbara then?
I think so. Yeah. I think that I liked Beetlejuice because I thought he was just really, really funny. And, you know, I was doing acting classes and I thought he was amazing. But just for different reasons now. Mm-hmm. I just think that Lydia is my favorite character now. Because everything she says,
she's definitely, you know, a cultural landmark now.
Yes.
Yep.
Especially with the cartoon.
And I wanted to talk about the cartoon, and I almost forgot, so thanks for reminding me.
No problem. Can I say what my favorite part of the movie was first? Before?
Oh, yeah, doo-doo-doo.
Oh, did you just call me doo-doo?
I did say doo-doo.
My favorite part of the movie is when Lydia runs up in the attic and says, you know, are you here? And they said, and Beetlejuice does the whole, they're gone, dead, afterlife kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then he explains that he wants to come out, but he can't tell her his name. And he comes up with all these rapid-fire excuses to get there.
Yes.
And then he does the thing in front of her, and she goes, ah, Beetle. Beetle breakfast? Beetle orange?
She can't
orange
get beetle? The second row. That was really
beetle,
good.
Beetle drink.
Beetle drink. Beetle,
beetle breakfast?
Water. Beetle.
The funny thing about that I remember is that it matched up with what Michael Keaton was saying about his reservations with doing too many Batman films.
Which was what?
Because then people would ask him to come to their kids' parties or shopping centers and signing autographs and shit like that. And so that came that kind of came from that, I think, when Michael Keaton was ad-libbing. Because the Beetlejuice and Batman came in rapid succession. It was like consecutive jobs for Keaton.
My favorite part was pretty much the monologue where he talks about his qualifications. Because it's just so reusable for everything.
It's so quotable, especially on a podcast.
Yes. But I gotta ask about the cartoon. Who's seen the cartoon?
Yep, I have, unfortunately.
So is he like a good guy in the cartoon?
Sorta, yeah.
He's far more clownish.
Okay.
He's got more of a platonic relationship with Lydia, although he obviously is still very, very much enamored of her.
So Lydia's a character on the cartoon.
Yes, there's nothing like naughty about their relationship.
And there, you don't see, I don't think you see the Maitlands at all, and you see the Dietzes rarely.
It's really more about what Lydia does in the, what do they call it, the Neither World?
The Neither World, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's more or less Lydia's adventures in the Neither World with Beetlejuice at the Beetlejuice Roadhouse where he lives.
Okay, so he's just like this sort of zany dead clown kind of thing?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah, he's much more clownish.
Very okay. much.
But mm-hmm. not in the terrifying clown way that we discussed in another podcast.
Calvin, I don't know if you know that Chris is terrified of clowns. And Pete. They freak them
too.
Both out.
Yes. Okay, so American Horror Story Freak Show would have sent him right out the door.
Very you know, I probably. Have, that's the only season I haven't watched.
And there's probably a reason for that.
Exactly.
So 6 years later, they remade Beetlejuice, and they called it The Mask.
Yes.
Which is funny, because I read the comic book by Dark Horse.
Uh-huh.
And it was close enough that I liked it, but giving kind of Jim Carrey free reign to improv, yeah, it was very Beetlejuice.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm thinking with all of the, you know, if CG had been around for this movie, what you would have seen would have come out much like The Mask.
Much like The Mask. And well, the thing is, Jim Carrey got a lot more screen time in The Mask than Michael Keaton got in Beetlejuice. I think it was a cumulative total of like 20 minutes.
Yeah, 17 he doesn't and a even half. Show up until the 45-minute mark.
Yeah.
17 and a half minutes.
Yeah, Chris actually timed it.
Yeah, well, I mean, he shows up, but only, you know, briefly and in fleeting, you know, in the commercials.
I'll eat anything you want you to eat. Yeah.
Right.
But he's got a total of 17 and a half minute screen time.
What was that movie, Silence of the Lambs, where Hannibal Lecter, you know, was on screen for maybe, what, 15 minutes?
Right, yeah.
I think he got an Oscar out of that?
Yeah, I think he's closer to, like, 22 or 23, but yeah.
And I think Beetlejuice's own, the Michael Keaton's script that he had to work from was similarly brief, because for some of those things, the script writer simply wrote down, Beetlejuice does something. And he did.
So So how much of it was like ad lib?
I don't know. I think I think definitely that commercial on the TV was largely ad lib. His qualifications may have been ad lib.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Are we ready to rate this movie?
I know I am. How about you?
Hell yes.
All right, Calvin. Since you're new here, I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
On a scale of 1 to 5 gold pieces, how do you rate Beetlejuice?
5 gold pieces.
All right, Pete. On a scale of 1 to 5 gold pieces, how do you rate Beetlejuice?
I rate Beetlejuice 5 gold pieces, and I rate you dead sexy.
You're not wrong.
You go next, Chris. Sure. You go next.
Okay.
You go next. Yeah.
Well, then you got to ask me, Sharon.
Chris, on a scale of 1 to 5 gold pieces, how many would you give this movie, Beetlejuice?
I am going to give Beetlejuice 4 gold pieces. Just because some of the effects don't really stand up over time, and there's a little bit of a drag in the middle. Sharon, on a scale of 1 to 5 gold pieces, how do you rate Beetlejuice? This is not a hard question. You've had plenty of time to think about it.
I know.
But she wants to rate it low, and she doesn't want to insult Calvin and I.
I'm afraid, but okay. Can I preface it with something?
You may.
Only because, being a blind person, there's a lot of visual stuff that I'm not getting that other people are getting. So I'm going to say 3.5. Don't kill me.
No.
No. Why would we?
I mean, I like it, but...
Well, you're sleeping on the couch tonight.
I'm
but
sorry.
I'm not
going to
kill
it's
you.
Not like it's not like you gave Princess Bride 3 coins.
Right?
I gave Princess Bride 5. But, you know, it's not, I know I'm a geek.
I said we.
There are things that I really love about it, and then there are things that I was just sort of, I just kept asking Chris, like, what's happening? And he had to describe it. So, and I think that, you know, just, I have to be true to my people, you know.
Absolutely.
Blind people. I can't say like, oh, this is a great movie for blind folks because it's
visual. It is. It's so visual that yes, I could see how that would
detract from you. So you know, 3 means you know, good. It was good, average. You know, and I think I said 3.5. So
you did
leaning toward 4 for me.
No, you've ruined it already.
Oh, okay.
Blew it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So three, huh?
That said, I'm going to go change my vote on Princess Bride now.
Mm-hmm.
Oh!
Well, for everyone out there in podcast land, go to our website, dragonreel.com, and give us your rating for Beetlejuice and all of our other fantastic shows that we've reviewed. And you can go to, you can find us at dragonreel.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, at dragonreel.
You can also find us on Facebook.
Yes, you can. How would they do such a thing?
They would look up Dragonreel on Facebook. That's D-R-A-G-O-N-R-E-E-L.
Like a reel of film?
Like a reel of film.
That's awesome.
And you can leave us, you can rate and leave a message there as well, if you'd like.
Yeah, that'd be cool, too. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher, and you should give us a review over there, recommend us, spread the word. You can follow us on Tumblr from our sister podcast, RuleZeroPodcast.tumblr.com, and you can check out the Rule Zero Podcast at RuleZeroPodcast.com.
Woohoo!
Calvin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Do you have a public presence that people can find you at? No is an okay answer if you don't. But
a public presence? No.
Okay.
Not really.
Okay.
What about your acting troupe?
Oh, Tater Patch Players.
Where are they based out of?
They are based in Jasper, Georgia, up in
Do
the
they have a presence?
They have a presence on Facebook, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So check them out. What Sharon, do you want to pimp anything while you're on here?
My blog, Teaching with Sight, at blogspot.com.
Excellent.
Nice.
So that's where we all are. You join us. We'll have a great big conversation and a big group hug.
Mm.
Aww.
Mm.
Yeah. And have a happy Halloween, everybody.
Happy Halloween.
Dragon Reel would like to extend a special thanks to Matt Bassano for composing the music you're listening to right now, especially for this show and our sister show, The Rule Zero Podcast. You can find more of his work at Ad Hoc Entertainment on the web at adhocbands.com.